Hello, this is Bob and Cameron McEwen, and we're continuing our series on my book on Trump and the tech body, and this is going to be the 57th episode. It's September 29th, 2022, and we are on page 115 at the top, and we're going to start off with one of my favorite quotes, which was on the back of Take Today, on the cover, on the sleeve. I don't think it was in the book. What do you think? Is this page in the book, and it was just put on the cover, or I don't have a page for it inside the book.
Right.
Have you got a search thing for Take Today? A PDF?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, I can look that up.
Yeah, look up undulated. Undulated sirens. That's a sentence. That's a two
yeah,
words.
You like phrases like that, Bob.
Yes, yes. I'm a poet, Cameron.
Yeah.
Old school. Back before Homer. So, okay, so this quote, as you're looking, I'll say it's on the cover sleeve on the back of the book, and the book is Take Today, The Executive's Dropout, 1972, very important book. And here's the quote. Barry Nevitt or McLuhan wrote, most likely Barry Nevitt, and then McLuhan approved it. Half the world today is engaged in keeping the other half under surveillance. And under surveillance is in quotes. This, in fact, is the hang-up of the age of software, and software is in quotes, and information. Software, in quotes, and information. In the preceding hardware age, hardware is in quotes, quotes, the haves is in quotes, of the world had kept the have-nots, which is in quotes, under surveillance, and surveillance is in quotes. So look at this. This is all this quoting. This, in fact, is a hang-up of the age of software and information. In the preceding hardware age, the haves of the world had kept the have-nots under surveillance. This old beat for flatfoots, for younger people, that means detectives or spies, flatfoots. This old beat for flatfoots has now been relegated to the world of popular entertainment. And then in italics, this sentence, the police state is now a work of art, a bureaucratic ballet of undulated sirens, end of italicized part. That is a way of saying, they go on, that is a way of saying that the espionage activities of our multitudinous manhunters and crediting agencies, crediting in quotes, are not only archaic, but redundant and irrelevant. So, repeat that. That is a way of saying that the espionage activities of our multitudinous manhunters and crediting agencies are not only archaic, but redundant and irrelevant. And as he says earlier, relegated to the world of popular entertainment. So all this spy stuff, Watergate, assassinations, conspiracies, is entertainment. And it is redundant and irrelevant because everything they're doing is in quotes. There is no hardware age. There aren't no haves or have-nots. And they're not under surveillance. There's something more involved. So let's see if we can unpack this.
What do you think the word hang-up means in that
that's
quotation?
Our cul-de-sac, you know, our major theme, the cul-de-sac. This is the cul-de-sac of the age of software and information.
Yes, I think that's certainly part of it, but doesn't hang up also have to do with dropout, with disconnection, It's a polyvalent term, right?
Well, back in the 60s, people talked psychologically. I have hang-ups about this or that, meaning they would balk at it. They weren't cool about it, or they thought they were too hot about something, right? And they're supposed to be cool. So it was an irritation. That was the personal use of it. McLuhan, of course, made it part of the media world, or the Android meme, or the technology's cognitive drama of cognition, the hang-up of the age of software and information. It's a good pun on the telephone and the fact that nobody was matching in that sense of communication. This is the hang. In a way, that's what you were saying, is the disconnection,
yeah.
Not connecting in the old community sense, right? This is the hang up. This is the dropout of the age of software. But that's a bit eccentric to use that term. It's not an immediate reaction of people. They'll just take it on the slang level. It's a problem that people have, something they're embarrassed by, maybe. And back then, nobody admitted they were spying on everybody. Now, that's your daily bread is espionage. As McLuhan says in Cliched Archetype, espionage is our daily activity. And, of course, that meant focus groups, polling, any kind of trying to get a profile of the crowd. Then the
doing anything, doing a search, walking into a certain store, buying gasoline, all of that is...
That's an effect of the global theater. Everybody is a put-on. Everybody's an actor. Nobody is, quote, genuine. They're all acting, following a script that they're inventing or that they think they've been assigned, which means you don't know anybody's motives. Or it was a world where people's motives were irrelevant. They were dangerous anyways, no matter what.
Mm-hmm. So I looked up the Undulated Sirens. It's only on the book cover.
Isn't that interesting? That means Barry wrote it, and it was on a page that was rejected, but the quote was left over. And they stuck it on the book.
I think the same thing that's true. I think, wasn't there a long advertisement for Take Today that had several paragraphs of stuff that was not only taken from the book? Some of it was taken from the book, but it was an enlargement of the book.
Wow, I've never seen that. That would be interesting to
see. I'll
see
if I can find it for you.
Yeah, so there's stuff on there that isn't in the book, you're thinking.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Well, that's McLuhan, you know, dropping it here and there. You got to check out every corner of McLuhan's room. You don't assume that he isn't hiding some things or fooling you or putting you on by putting the good stuff over there where you wouldn't look, right? Wouldn't expect it. Very conscious of every item of input he was creating. You know what I mean? Carefully painting.
Yeah. Do you think that he had an idea of a sort of control like that? Or do you think he just let himself into the universal undulation?
No, he was very conscious. Matter of fact, if he had Barry write the stuff, that makes it easier for him to surveil it all, right? He can see everything. It gives him a level of detachment, and then he can think of other things to do with it, to play with it. So I think that's part of having a co-writer. It gave him a better position to sculpt the thing, program it. So, yep, no, I think that McLuhan, people like to say that he was sloppy, coat-fitting his wake, and give no attribution. He'd get the wrong page number and all this. I was reviewing The Lion and the Fox by Wyndham Lewis, the first book after he surfaces, after the miracle year of 1922, where Eliot gets famous with The Wasteland and Joyce gets famous with Ulysses, so Lewis is left out. So he retreats in 23, 24. And he writes this huge 1,500-page thing called A Man of the World, I think it was. And then he proceeds over the next 6 years to chop it up and make six different books out of it. The first book he put out from it was on the role of the hero in Shakespeare plays. It was called The Lion and the Fox. So we were reviewing it, this Lewis study group, and people were pointing out the numerous mistakes the guy had, is if he wasn't, he didn't check what he wrote. He didn't edit it or really care. And so people thought, you know, he was lazy or hectic or something. I'm thinking he did it on purpose, like McLuhan did. He put the mistakes in on purpose for some reason, maybe just to see if you're reading carefully. Satire and the fact that he could do it and nobody reads anymore, really, so they miss it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think.
Well, in McLuhan's case, he thought that correcting and rereading was sort of a Gutenbergian activity.
Yeah, yeah. He and said he never reread. He never read his work. He never liked listening to it or anything.
Correct.
So that was a conscious move.
That's why I say I don't think he thought in terms of control. I think he thought that in a world of no identity, in a world of no fixed place or fixed time, all I can do is attempt to ride the wave.
Well, he in Radio and TV versus the Absent-Minded, one of those mid-50s essays and explorations, I think I brought it up. It ends, it might be the media as art forms, as political art forms or something. He's writing at the end, and then it just merges with a direct section out of Finnegan's Wake with no attribution. So he's becoming Finnegan's Wake if it's conscious. And I always thought that was conscious. But I pointed out to Eric, and he said, no, that's a mistake. So they didn't think it was conscious, so... So maybe my view is a minority that he...
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. Eric had a different view of exactitude than his father did. Eric's mind was not as focused as Marshall's, in my view. But as a result of that, Eric was more concerned with particular points than Marshall was.
Right. Did you get to know Eric when you were negotiating with Corinne and
yes.
with George Sanderson?
Yes, I got to know Eric actually before Corinne. And we were fairly good friends. I mean, certainly not close,
yeah.
But I knew Eric fairly well.
Did you ever visit him?
Yes, no, but not at the farm.
Right, before that, on the east, at the East End, I was at that house. In the 70s, would you say, or?
No. I didn't meet Eric until the 90s.
So he hadn't gone?
Oh, well, no, I shouldn't say that. I think when I met Marshall, I think Eric was around.
1969, 70.
This is right. Yeah, right around 1970, maybe 1969, even 68, maybe.
And you went and visited Eric at his home then, you said?
No, I didn't visit him at his home. I only met him along with Marshall at the center.
Right. But so, yeah, you got involved with him on the level we're talking about with George Sanderson in the 90s, doing that proposal.
Well, sort of, but I what I was doing with George was certainly connected with Eric and Corinne, but it was also two different paths, you could say, because although George and I were definitely on the same page as regards electronic publishing and as regards how McLuhan needed to be made available, we didn't have the same sense of why McLuhan was important.
Really?
Yeah. But
what did George? What was his reason?
Well, George thought. I'm not saying George was wrong and I was right.
Yeah.
We just had slightly different views. George thought that McLuhan's thought was generally unappreciated, and he believed that it was unappreciated in the family. Mm-hmm. And what he was trying to do was sort out how McLuhan could be published more or less against what the family was trying to do to sort of protect McLuhan.
Right.
George thought McLuhan didn't need protection. He just needed to be got out there. So I didn't disagree with that, but I just, that wasn't my focus. My focus was on trying to understand what McLuhan was up to and how that project could be continued. And I've sort of never left that way of thinking about it.
Right. So for George, it was finished. You know, McLuhan Project was finished. He didn't have a way of continuing it, like you're saying. You felt
right.
It could.
I don't, in my view, George didn't understand McLuhan as sort of passing on a task to us. He understood McLuhan as something that was very significant for Canada, and something that was potentially significant for the Maritimes. And he was working to sort of bring that to fruition.
Yeah, as was the very... head of the Antigonish Review, you know, that was his role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
But George was very frustrated with all this. He continually thought he had an agreement, and then it would turn out he didn't have an agreement. And...
Yeah. The Mady-Molnaro problem. It was everybody had complaints about her if they had to do something with McLuhan's materials.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know if that she was.
Yeah, she was certainly very influential with Corinne.
Yeah. So George was frustrated. Yeah. So okay. We got on that about. So Eric. So you got to know Eric a bit, and your commentary on his style was based on talking to him, knowing him a bit?
Yeah. And then trying to, you know, if you read Laws of Media, you have to kind of figure out how the bits and pieces of Marshall were put together by Eric.
Yeah.
And you have to... then you have to figure out, well, have these things been put together correctly, or is it somehow misleading? Misleading in sort of the concrete sense, taking you away from what Marshall is up to.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, in many ways, Eric understood his father like nobody else. Because they were very close, personally. But I think, Eric, didn't understand, the sort of the central matter in McLuhan, which has to do with what you call tactility.
Yeah.
And, what I would call, discontinuous.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, we got onto that because, the word hang up, was it? Did that we get into that?
Yeah, so and the question of were there things that were outside of the
his organizing the, his materials, how precise was he in this stuff and the ad for Take Today, was that done
correct.
By Barry? Right. Barry would have stuck stuff in that he thought was valuable. Marshall didn't notice, on your understanding.
Maybe he didn't care.
Yeah, he didn't care. But and remember, this is coming out right before or the same month as Watergate. I was in New York in July 72 for the first Newport, New York Jazz Festival. First time they did it in New York. It was July. And walking down Madison Avenue or something, there in the bookstore was the Take Today in the window. I didn't look at it at that point. I was too distracted with the music and all that, but I definitely remember that. And Watergate happens on June something. So that's a month before. But the people don't know Watergate's not a big deal yet. You know what I mean? And here's a book dealing with that world. And so when he was asked to comment on Watergate in 73, he was talking about it as theater, as a two levels, manhunting and something else. I don't know what the other level was, but it was the first time I heard him talk about manhunting. And that's in this quote here, multitudinous manhunters.
And but see, in this this quote has the subtitle of Tate Today, The Executive is Dropout. So when I see the word hang up, which is also, that's on the cover of Tate Today, right?
Yeah.
A phone that's disconnected.
Yes. And dangling.
Yeah. So to me, the word hang up has to do with something that is sort of unresolved and points the way to something else. And so when he's talking about the universal surveillance being the hang-up, he seems to be saying that we think that this is surveillance, but surveillance belongs to the hardware world. In fact, it's something else. And
that's why everything's in quotes, because all the stuff that people think goes along with the spy world is not real. It's a fake. And so their surveillance is not the way people think of surveillance. There's a whole other level of surveillance that your garbage man is involved in and everybody else in the global theater. So that's why everything's in quotes, because the hang-up is thinking there's software and information and hardware and haves and have-nots. All those categories are delusions. They do not, you cannot define them if you include the participatory Android meme factors that are going on and the co-creation of everything in the global tactility. You can't make categories.
Mm-hmm. So is he, in your view, is he the thing that he's pointing to as opposed to the, he's looking in the rearview mirror. And he's saying, okay, here are these images, and the images are only a hang up in the sense of something that doesn't make sense, something that doesn't cohere. So he's pointing to something else, and the something else seems to be the sentence that's in italics.
Yeah.
The police state is now a work of art, a bureaucratic delay of undulated sirens. So in your view, is the thing that he's pointing to that the world as a work of art is not the work of art of individuals?
Right.
It's a work of art that is some sort of an undulation in which we are located, but which we cannot steer as if we were in the hardware world.
Yeah, it's the environments, the corporate environments that are in interplay. So normal human big brother worries or Orwellian worries is not the issue. It's not a world of paranoia. It becomes a world of paranoia because everybody doesn't get what's going on. So that's a rearview mirror reaction. And that's why he's saying it's a work of art. It's a ballet. He's saying the police state is not what it used to be. It's a new thing. And he says that in Gutenberg Galaxy. Big Brother went inside. It's not marching around the streets like in the 30s. And then you're involved with espionage. Everything you do is espionage. So to make a... to keep the image of government and Washington bureaucracy going, they pretend that there's something that must be surveilled and protected from. So they take a bunch of students, make a big deal out of them, right? They're just blowing up little scuffles in the street, making them threaten the calm in suburbia. And that's the work of art. It's a programmed image, an intended image, to distract you from the fact that nothing is going on that you expect. And that was Foucault's point, is that the protesters and that were putting energy into the authorities. Foucault said, ignore them. Then they have no role. You're creating a role for them by protesting against them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a second level, more amateurish understanding of what McLuhan's talking about. Foucault could see something about the work of art, but he wasn't as poetic as McLuhan or as accurate.
Mm-hmm. So this tends towards McLuhan's talk about orientalizing, right?
Yeah. Orientalizing, that's the Chinese bureaucracy. That's happening to the West. And the China, they just, this is the time when Nixon goes over and allows China into the capitalist world, right? That's the beginning of all these students coming over, putting on the left hemisphere, if you believe in those categories, but, you know, putting on the West. They take over the universities over the next 30 years. That's the westernizing of the East. That's part of the undulated. So what is undulated, you know, andulated, undulating?
Yeah.
Is undulated a word?
Yeah, undulated is a word, yes. And but the UN, the UN.
Oh, yeah.
That does not have the meaning of not. Undula is Latin for wave. So undulated means waved or waving. It's an image of the sea cresting, and the sirens are riding those waves.
Right, the surface of the liquid undulated gently, or the landscape rolled and undulated for miles in every direction. So it's a smooth thing. I was thinking of it more as dancing, but it's not dancing. It's just the rolling of the sea. So
correct.
The ballet of so acoustic attention-getting things are the sirens, but they're going up and down in economic cycles. Maybe pendulum swinging in public mood.
Right, but sirens itself is just like a wave is going up and down. The sirens, as in the Odyssey, can be misleading, enticing to danger.
Yeah.
But sirens can also, if they're properly understood, can indicate the right way. So this is an image of sort of the way up is the way down. It's membrane that you like to refer to all the time.
Yeah.
It's a corporate status where the individual needs to find him or herself, not in terms of private identity. That's a very difficult matter to try to think about.
Right. And undulating signs would be the up and down of recession, boom, bust, the statistics of the economy, the sculpting of the crowd, profile of the crowd in economic
terms. Well, partly
terms.
That, but also ontologically. It's reality. It's the way things are.
Right. And people think the economics is reality. So if you focus on that, you...
Exactly. In order for the economics to be what it is, going up and down, it needs to have an ontological foundation.
Yeah. Is he saying the espionage activities and the crediting agencies are archaic, redundant, and irrelevant? So the the norms of economic worries that came in the 70s and continued, the austerity conditions and all these different proposals, wage and price controls and that, they were all red herrings for a new incredible, quote, freedom, let's put that in quotes, freedom of expression, freedom of wealth, freedom of information, freedom of distraction, freedom of delusion, a wonderful psychedelic trip that the whole society, the whole global theater was on. That's what was going on. And
right, but those two sides, you could say, are both false.
Yeah.
Right? So it's thinking them together that makes sense.
Yeah. And so McLuhan suspended judgment. There's a lot of left hemisphere Gutenbergian judgment going on, appraisal and valuing this over that. A lot of useless creating statuses or hierarchies irrelevant.
But on the other hand, if you didn't have that, then you wouldn't have anything.
That's right.
There's always going to be limited situations. It can be economic, political, personal, whatever. The limited situations are the way that the undulation expresses itself. So the limited situations need to be seen in their correlation, and that's why they are redundant and irrelevant if taken in themselves.
Yes,
but
right.
If they're seen against the background of their possibility, then they're not redundant and they're not irrelevant.
Yeah. So the old-fashioned wealth, or when he did the tetrad on the credit card, it enhanced prestige. So person's identity and prestige is enhanced within the Gutenberg categories of economics. And so that was the content, the watchdog of the mind, you know, the beef put out for the dog. So much of what was called economic activity was just old, obsolete forms. He also said today, it's a global theater of endless repertoire. We could retrieve any event we want. So a lot of retrieval of all kinds of scenarios to hide the fact that we'd gone into the total void or Big Bang. We were not anywhere's measurable, and of course that's what Finnegan's Wake was trying to show. You know, the 6 degrees of separation, 14 degrees of freedom of motion and all that, they were not the way one lived. No, that wasn't your actual being. So there was no way to communicate that. So people would recognize the fallacies of their games and they play in their professions, and it would bother them, the futility of it, so they drop out and go into the silence for a while and actually half confront the void.
Yeah.
That was so happening.
So the present situation that we have in Ukraine and the destruction of the pipelines and sort of universal war and stuff, is all an attempt to avoid that dropout.
The larger war, the larger disaster, the larger Armageddon. The fact that everything disappeared, or it was, as McLuhan said, by 1950, there's no human life anymore. And if you think somebody's caring for the planet and they wouldn't let it go, nope, that's not the case. They're going to go to the moon. They can grow vegetables on the moon.
Yeah. So they think. Yeah. So growing vegetables on the moon means something like, let's go to war and we'll be able to cultivate peace through that.
Yeah.
Right, which is ridiculous, but that's the entire world is caught up in that right now.
Yeah, and but you said we need that. In a time of peace, we can play act of that we're preventing war and things like that and appear to be in control of it. That is the content to make wealth. Then that has to flip, like a tetrad, into the facts of none of it has any meaning. None of it is really the ground of what's going on. So people always crack up in that situation and burn out or get drug addicted or alcoholic or destroy their families. All kinds of ridiculous stuff goes on when they can't take the grind of the old ways that makes wealth. Because that wealth doesn't have any staying power.
Correct.
The real wealth is the ability to sit back and watch the information vortex, to be able to watch and enjoy the spectacle. That is the wealth that everybody would like to have more time to do. They used to, anyways, have more time to do, but they had harassed lives. They had to go pay their mortgage. They had to work in different jobs that really didn't go anywhere and just made everything worse. And that would bother people because they couldn't, they were missing out on their favorite TV shows and were the real wealth that was being made. The new experiences that was happening in TV shows.
Yeah.
So what people, I would hear people say, well, you know, my father, you can't talk to him Sunday night. He watches Columbo and you can't interrupt him. It's the only TV he gets each week, right? But it's almost a church service. He has to do it, and the family has to disappear.
Sure.
Don't bug him. He's got to watch Columbo.
That's like the NFL.
Yes,
right? The
Monday Night
NFL
Football.
NFL is the new church.
Yeah, yeah. And that was so immature from my perspective. I always say, I don't watch football. I play it, for fuck's sake. Where's the game? Let's play. Why should I watch a bunch of other people playing? Yeah, there was nothing more indicative of paralysis, social paralysis, and the fact that people had this Monday Night Football obsession. Boy, that was really a hang-up. That was a hang-up, a disconnect. Back to,
sure, but
you know, and I'm not an anti-jock. I'm a jock. I like sports. But to make a ritual out of that and then get out of shape while doing it, that's a big sin.
Yeah, yeah. I notice how Monday Night Football has become Thursday Night Football, has become Sunday Night Football. Right? It's gradually taking over the week.
Yeah. Yeah, that's blatant addiction, isn't it? You need more and more of it to get the hit, to get the satisfaction from it.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the satisfaction behind it all is the amount of control, the amount of money, the amount of prestige that the people have that own the teams or that present what's going on TV or that are the networks that control all this. All of this is the...
That's the work of art.
but at the first level, it's what he calls the haves.
The haves.
Right? It's the haves.
Yeah.
And then you have to see, well, the haves, really, that's itself a work of art. And then the work of art of having, that itself is an aspect of the undulation.
Yeah.
Right? And so the
because
whole
you could become
is,
a have-not.
You are a have-not.
Yes. Yeah, that could be become
right?
A
that's
figure.
The hang-up.
Right. Yeah, the haves of the world have kept the have-nots under surveillance, and yet if you're surveilling somebody, you're under surveillance too.
Correct. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You cannot surveil except by sort of marking your activity.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? You need machines, you need recording devices, you need all the stuff that goes into surveilling.
Yeah. And then they pick one iconic event like Watergate, and then so much is done for the next couple of years around Watergate, books and movies and distraction and trying to find out who did what to who, and it's always a mystery. Nothing is explained because the terms that explain it aren't dealing with the issue. It's alchemy and not doing chemistry in your terms.
Correct.
So
yeah, it would be interesting to look at a Watergate and try to understand what was going on there sort of in Trumpian terms. What is it about Nixon and Trump, about the two of them together, that needed to be canceled?
Yeah. Yeah, now McLuhan said Watergate was a battle between television and the newspaper over the advertising dollar. You ever hear of that statement?
No, but it makes sense.
Yeah. So it was a war for the entertainment, the coverage in the world of things.
Yeah.
What people would, the content.
It's a good example of what you sometimes talk about, of the war of the media.
Yeah, yeah. The I have McLuhan's statement back in the 50s, the media as political art forms. I saw an art critic, he wrote an essay on McLuhan years ago, 5 years ago or something, and he noticed a quote that McLuhan said, Canada is the great artist of our time. Not a person, it was a corporation, you know, a corporate image, Canada. And that's what the art world won't deal with, is McLuhan as the great art critic was showing and measuring the ballet of bureaucratic undulating iconic institutions. That was... Canada was the greatest artist because it was not involved in any of the particular worlds, the four worlds. It was on the sidelines and in the gap. And so a guy like Pearson could be hoiked up as a peacemaker.
Uh-huh.
And
this has reminded me of a funny quotation that I just saw the other day, and I made a note of it. It's in his lecture in 1966. The medium is the massage. The lecture he made at the Y.
Yeah,
in
92nd Street, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So here's the quote. He says, those who lived through the 19th century lived through the most stupefying and fragmenting and systematizing and categorizing century in human history. So the first thing to note about that is that that's what McLuhan was involved in when he was at the University of Manitoba.
Yes.
He wrote his thesis on George Meredith, who lived from the start of the 19th century until he ended. Right.
Right.
So, and then listen to this. And then he says, Canada is in a peculiar position. Canada never had anything but a 19th century.
That's all we had. We have never had anything else.
The most stupefying, fragmenting, and systematizing and categorizing century in human history. And that is what Canada is.
Right. Now, Canada became, in the global theater, though, it had this image of a nice place. It didn't,
absolutely.
Kids didn't go to Vietnam. And he said they had an image of utopia. That's the artist. It was the hip place. And modern comfort.
It threw it all away, but that's
It was a great artist for a while. Like all great arts, they all fail. All great artists, they fail. They get eaten up, from Dali to Warhol. They're like celebrities. It's not a good fate. But this guy, he noted that quote, and he didn't know what to make of it because he was an art critic, Gutenbergian art critic, and they just ignored it. But he said, that's puzzling. That's an odd statement by Marshall, but that's a key thing. you know, Ted Carpenter was down there in New York in the art world because his wife was part of the what were they called? The Schlumberger family, Demoniel family, and they ran the art world from Warhol mm-hmm. to the guys who sculpted planetary art out in the desert. And that was not. Now, Ted Carpenter told me he didn't like the later McLuhan, the guy who got into, you know, more radio in Venezuela, programming the global environments. He said, I appreciate the early McLuhan, the aesthetic McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
That's the 50s. And McLuhan, but there's Ted. He's in the art, Gutenbergian art world. He's being an aesthete. So it led what he preferred. That's where he ended up. And, you know, the children of, and one of them was his wife, of the Demoniel matriarchy, all fought over different parts of the art world. They had different agendas in their mm-hmm. privileged mm-hmm. position. And that was the very distraction that McLuhan has in his preface, I think, to Understanding Media, about how irrelevant the art world is and what they emphasize. And they had no clue that we're in a bureaucratic ballet of undulating sirens
right.
where even Orwell is just a work of art. It's not the future. It's 1934. So that's the kind of stuff that I wanted people to talk about. You know, that's big thinking. That gets you out of all the stupid little Gutenbergian issues, like
yeah.
race.
But the... at the same time, we have to appreciate Carpenter's objection. And Carpenter's objection is, yeah, but we have to do something, right? We need to appreciate what good art is. And if there's good art, then it needs to be put into some sort of context, like the museum in Houston that they built. And we have to try to preserve Eskimo language, or we have to try to preserve the totem poles that the Haida are just leaving to rot someplace.
Mm.
So what Carpenter is thinking isn't stupid, and in a sense it's necessary. And what McLuhan is advising against that is also necessary, but it's very difficult, right? To McLuhan, you can see him sort of lying on his couch and drinking a beer and sort of letting all that stuff go.
Yep.
The tension between the two guys is quite enormous, and I think is important to think about.
Yeah, and Carpenter couldn't take it. He took the scandal of his own divorce in TV in the 50s in Toronto as mm-hmm. an excuse to get away from McLuhan.
Yeah. Well, in the there's a letter from, I think it's 1956, in which McLuhan writes to another Catholic literature professor down in Florida. And he says, good news, I think Carpenter is going to convert. Right? And when ultimately McLuhan and Carpenter came to a certain
impact.
Crossroads, and Carpenter couldn't keep going with McLuhan along the road he was going.
Yeah. And that was the figure of it. McLuhan was trying to convert him, trying to have him be converted. And Carpenter is too much of a, you know, marine, freewheeling pagan to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, he couldn't, you know, whenever anybody wants to think, they have to decide if they are going to allow themselves to be subservient to thought or if they are going to steer it. And if you decide usually unconsciously, but if you decide that you're going to steer your thought, then you can never start to think. Right? That's sort of the ultimate switch.
Yeah.
Right? You either become subservient to the thinking that goes on through you, like channeling.
Yeah.
Or you try to steer your thought like a car.
Yeah.
And the latter is not thinking.
Right. We're talking about Carpenter. So Carpenter runs. Oh yeah, Barry Nevitt. Did I ever tell you how Marshall did it to Barry in the 70s? He kept trying to get Barry to convert. Never mentioned.
No, that's interesting. Talk about that.
Yeah. So Barry said he'd have a winsome smile, impish smile as he talked to me about it. He said, Marshall will try to get you to convert eventually if you get close to him and you're working with him. Uh-huh. That's what he will do. And what Barry, in that book, Who is Marshall McLuhan? Do you have that book?
Yes. Not right here, but I have it.
Yeah, Barry, I think in there, quotes himself asking Marshall, what would you do if you found that you were dead? And Marshall said, plunge ahead. So Barry would use that, and he used it back on Marshall, I think. Marshall said, Barry, why don't you convert? And Barry had some flippant answer like that. No, Marshall, I'm just going to plunge ahead. I don't think that's necessary right now. So everybody, hanging around McLuhan, you suddenly realize, uh-oh, this guy has the jet. Was that steering his thought? Is McLuhan steering his thought?
I didn't understand you there.
Is McLuhan steering his thought when he has an agenda to convert you?
Well, no. I mean, that's the big question, right? How do you do something that is not steering? That's a very, very difficult question.
Right.
So the whole idea of becoming free by submitting to something that's involved in conversion. So the question then becomes, is conversion to something particular, like the Catholic Church today or something, need, in submitting to something larger than yourself, do you have to submit to something particular, or can submission be made to something like the undulation in that quote?
Yeah.
Here's
the undulation. This person was telling me they were gambling in Las Vegas or something, and it was a process that those things you pull on,
Yeah, slot machine.
Slot machine, just something. She was doing something like that, and it was working, and she was winning. Then she noticed she was winning, and it would stop.
Yeah.
So then she'd say, okay, keep doing it. Don't notice you're winning. Just keep doing it. So it's good. You're riding it. Almost like don't have an orgasm. Keep doing it and avoid thinking about it. So she was in the interval between steering her thought and submitting yourself. That was the ultimate, I thought, expression of tactility, the interplay between you and the environment. And,
correct.
And you can screw it up by noticing it.
Yeah, yeah. It's like trying to fall asleep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in sports, for example, when you play a sport very well, you cannot be thinking about what you're doing.
Yeah.
You have to go with the game. You have to let the puck come to you or let the ball come to you. And it's a wonderful feeling when you do that. but it's not something that you can do sort of with intent or consciously, because that screws it up.
Yeah. So the other thing Barry said was, in this sort of religious context, he said, when you die, he says, you go to this place where there are no secrets. Everybody knows everything about mm-hmm. you and everything else. That was yeah. his image of the afterlife. And he knew that's where the world was becoming secularly. There was no privacy, no mm-hmm. secrets. So that's how Marshall said that we are simulating the body of Christ with the global membrane. An aspect of that would be the surveillance, the no secrets. That's an aspect of state of heaven or something that Jesus was supposed to represent or bring in or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That was the what do they think? They say, oh, okay, McLuhan says the prince of the air is a great engineer, and it's Lucifer. He's programming the environment, and that's yet many people mistake that for some mystical body of Christ. He said a Dante vision.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But they don't think of this, of Barry's point, that everybody knows everything in heaven, and that we were simulating that, no secrets, in more and more. And now many people resign themselves that they can't have privacy. And they're probably bothered by it and get nervous ticks about it. But the last 10 years has shown people that it's impossible to stay in the old world of privacy.
Sure.
So
privacy also has to do with trying to have things, trying to have wealth, trying to have fame.
Yeah.
Right. All of these things are impossible in a certain sense. But notice in a world where everybody knows everything, how that has to do with McLuhan's mode of composition, especially in the last 20 years of his life. If everybody knows everything, then why go back and correct things and make them,
yeah.
quote unquote, right?
Yeah, so what did you say just before that? So the before the mode of composition, so Barry
was talking about
no secret,
wealth and
the privacy. Privacy. So people would acquire objects and wealth. They'd become some particular media that they wanted to lose their identity in, and that would be their identity. The merging with old environments, the old scraps, he called it, was the solution for people who couldn't stand the fact that there was no privacy. So so in privacy, what did he say? Privacy is putting media over yourself. He used to say in Mechanical Bride that the tribal person would wear the skin of a cougar or something, an animal, and
mm-hmm.
and put on what he was afraid of.
Yep.
So people put on cars and wealth and buying art and all whatever prestige activities there are, country clubs and that, they were put on because they were afraid. So they put on the old. I don't know how. Okay, so the travel guy puts on, he's pushing himself, probing himself by putting the skin of the animal, which he's afraid of. That's not what people who are looking for comfort and wealth and retrieving privacy are doing. They are they're trying to stop the probing.
Sure. Well, both are going on at the same time, right?
Yeah, trying to numb themselves. And
yeah.
Notice
how this is the process of print, right? In order for print to be legible, you have to have edges. You have to know where the black is and where the white is. So this idea of putting on an identity as something that defines you positively, but also reflects you negatively in terms of the fear that it's avoiding. This is all Gutenbergian. This
yeah.
whole complex is a way of drawing borders so that the black letter can be seen against the white page.
Yeah, so that's why, for anybody who's interested, under surveillance, software, haves and have-nots, crediting agencies, surveillance have to be in quotes. They're all Gutenbergian.
Yep.
They're all avoiding the merger, the collective consciousness of the global membrane that puts everybody beyond any normal tribal, personal, psychological categories of identity. See, there's no race, there's no sex, there's no class, there's not any of those things that the recently woke people are making a big issue about. Gender, class, and what is it, and race, and is that the three things? Race, class, and gender? I think so. Those came in with the printing press and have gone, and it's the only thing that people can get violent about because it's a rearview mirror, so they can pretend they're noticing something. The void.
Mm-hmm.
And then now, as a result of COVID, it's almost like the bureaucratic siren said, we accept the guaranteed income. We're not going to give you a guaranteed income. We're not going to admit that. We're not going to say that's it. But everybody gets a basic stipend now, and they don't have to work. It flipped into so I was just saying that people struggled for Gutenbergian categories, but that's been erased by the COVID thing. You can't get status. You just get your basic stipend that keeps you going. That's a radical change in society. That has gone past the categories that we're discussing in this quote. Everybody's now allowed to be in the same
boat. Yeah, right.
In the same boat, or in Cronenberg's movie version of Naked Lunch, he has people. It's a scene from Burroughs' writing. They're all sucking in some tube, some nectar. That's what everybody can have now. They can have the nectar for very little cost.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
it does. I don't know is there an identity crisis about that now? People are very concerned about what's happening to their children in schools.
Very concerned. Yeah.
Yeah.
for decades, we've thrown our children into huge factories. We haven't cared about teacher education or teacher salaries.
Yeah.
We haven't tried to figure out what exactly should children know.
Yeah.
What should they learn? And then we call that being concerned about our children. It's
right.
Ridiculous.
Right. And so that's the distress. They're worried about that while their older kids who are in college or of that age, they're getting a stipend and won't work. So the parents are struggling over the younger brothers and sisters who are in the grade schools and getting abused. They could focus on that, but they don't deal with the fact that the older brothers and sisters are out of the house and just vegetating and don't want to do anything.
Yeah, and are becoming the teachers that are doing the uneducation of the younger ones.
Well, they're refusing to be teachers.
Yeah.
Have you heard that? They can't get nurses. They can't get this. They can't get that. They can't get anybody
yeah.
to be working. You
Correct.
know?
Yeah.
The ideal of the guaranteed income, certainly no one thought it would be accidentally stumbled into and done backwards for the wrong motives or something. You know, we've got the guaranteed
sure.
income, but it looks like somebody doesn't like this and wants to start a big war. Massive identity crisis in there.
Yeah, well, it's hard to know if the war is for the ongoing process or against it.
Yeah.
I kind of think that it's for the ongoing process, but
it's the
communist revolution in a way that nobody expected.
Yeah, the capitalists are bringing in the communists. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so you say we. It's emerging with the collectivity, and we can't afford everybody, so we start shooting and see who survives it. Then they'll have the communistic nectar when the dust settles, which is what
yeah.
you hear
well,
people. That's an old cliche. They always say, we can get into a really great world, but it's going to get worse before we do that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'd like to go to the idea of we can't afford that. But, of course, we can, because to afford something just means that you get the printing press to turn out dollars a little bit faster.
Yeah.
Right, affording is nowadays has nothing to do with actually paying for something. it just means deciding to throw some paper at it.
Yeah, so a big grievance is the wiping out the student loan of kids, and those that paid off their loans are outraged and probably not going to allow it to happen. So we have a lot of emotions. This is what I have on my chart: paranoia, schizophrenia, hysteria, panic, and ecstasy. A lot of these intensities are what our society is making wealth from, or statistic wealth, pretending their GNP is doing great, or just saying in bigger bank accounts. It's all based on overreaction, emoting about things. So that's what people say. Too many people are claiming to be victims. That's the mentality of having an emotion, an outrage about something. So,
all of these are ways of establishing identity, which is to say, establishing a certain limit. A certain border between what you take you to be and what you take you not to be, right? So it's all just Gutenberg is over, so we need more of it.
Yeah, and McLuhan said, if reality appears to be unstoppable, that frightens people. The unstoppability of this situation.
Yeah. Yeah, which is has two faces, right? It's got the face of over-management and the face of the impossibility of management.
Yeah, and the giving up of responsibilities.
Yeah, so it's like the question of the hang-up. Is the hang-up something that is kind of a negative fate, or is it a door to something? And take today as sort of a meditation on that question.
Yeah. So this quote, which is not in the book, but it's on the cover, so you got to have the cover to get it,
right.
Is you have to understand why these words are in quotes. You don't get McLuhan unless you understand why they are that way. That is, well, why are crediting agencies, why is crediting in quotes? It's you have to write that way when you know that the electric environment can't be bought, sold, or stolen. Right? That statement. Can't be bought, sold, or stolen. That erases all Gutenberg categories. And so then you have people pretending to keep other people under surveillance. And that's in quotes because it's not the action. So this is a quote trying to point out what is life like under the Android meme or the global membrane. So what I say underneath, let's see how I try to translate this. Okay, I just jumped ahead a second. So I say, they're putting it back into the old drama of pre-World War II, good and bad, trying to maintain a stable society, the old cop and spy world, and that's in quotes, whereas the real espionage is right in front of everybody on the TV shows and in the advertising agencies. They're programming the world, not secret places. They're only useful during a war. Occasionally you have a little outbreak. I guess that means the spies. You go fight in some garbage dump of the world. It brings back the old CIA guys. But the actual programming and spying is the news agencies, which have now come to be seen as enemies of the people. People have become, on a popular cliche slang level through Donald Trump, media ecologists. In a very crude way. They've got autonomy. They're not listening to the news. They don't take it seriously. And then I have a quote. You're trying to tell me something? Bob said that the Android meme is not talking to me. That's what they quote. They quote me. You're trying to tell me something. That's what Marshall one night said to this professor. You're trying to tell me something. Bob said the Android meme is not talking to me. The news is not talking to me. They're living that, now I'm saying they're living that attitude. They are media ecologists in the sense they're not looking at the content. They're not distracted by it. So we really had to up the content with plagues and drastic invasions and bring back the threat of nuclear war that people thought had long disappeared. They'd up the ante. And you could say they began that by knocking down the Twin Towers. That was a shocking image.
Is the stuff that you're reading, the stuff in blue, is that taken from some recording that where you were talking?
Yeah, I was talking to a friend, Bert in Switzerland, and then he would transcribe it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was recorded.
So I'm wondering, you have here... That they are programming the world. That is to say, the advertising agencies. So it says they're programming the world.
I think I mean they're the spy agencies, the fake Gutenbergian spy agencies, are trying to program the world in the old way, old cop and spy world.
Well, the sentence is they're programming the world, not secret places. And I think
the advertising agencies.
That's right. But I think the word places is a mistake in the transcription. I think it should be police.
Not secret police.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
but let me say, look, they're putting it back. The spies, the Big Brother, with the fake news, they're trying to put everything back into the old drama pre-World War II when you had identities.
Right.
And they think that'll maintain a stable society, the old cop and spy world. Whereas the real espionage is the advertising agencies, which
correct.
Is constant demand for adjustment. They're programming the world, that's advertising, not secret places.
Yeah.
The cops are doing the secret places illusion. See, it's not secret programming of the world by a secret elite. The program is right in front of us. You bring out the old cops and spies when you have an old hardware world. And you go fight in some garbage dump of the world. It brings back the old CIA guys. But the actual programming and spying is the news agencies. So they say McLuhan wasn't political. Well, he was. He took on the real politicians, which were the ad agencies. That was where the real issues of power were happening. Not in the political world of spies and political parties and managers of elections. But the actual and that all becomes entertainment. it was a rigged election. Do you know that the Democrats said it was a rigged election after 2016?
Yes.
And then the Republicans did it. But the actual programming and spying is the news agencies, which have now come to be seen as enemies of the people. Now I'm bringing it up to Trump time. People have become, on a popular cliche level through Donald Trump, media ecologists. They're demanding, you're trying to keep me informed of your constant disturbance, and I'm not having it anymore. I'm not listening to you guys. I'm looking at the form, not the content. See, so I see media ecology is becoming a popular reaction of a collectively conscious bunch of actors who have been doing it for 30, 40 years, and now they recognize what's duping them. They've become McLuhan. They're not looking at the content. You're not going to fool me with your content stuff, this war or that war. And so now, even so, the president had to say there's too many people out there who are conspiracy theorists. And what that means, he's complaining that nobody is taking the mainstream legacy media seriously. They've become McLuhanites. They are unconsciously looking at the form, not the content. And they say, what you're presenting is fake. That is a new grievance by the powerful. When Biden complains that everybody thinks there's a conspiracy going on. And the conspiracy theory or that mood is just every inflated first world person who's a king or queen of the mediascape not putting up with Big Brother playing games and trying to distract me. They're to make a fake, what they call that? A fake something. They say that the 911. There were a lot of exercises going on that day. And what do you call it? You have a fake hoax or there's a phrase, and people use it a lot now. And so this is why Alex Jones becomes a figure. He's acting out the objection to the managers of society emphasizing content, emphasizing the anthropomorphic, when there is none. And the people feel that. They see that there's no what society's trying to make you concerned about is not the issue, and that's what McLuhan said. What you want me to be concerned about is not the issue. There are other issues. So this is an important point to make. That the people
very important, but it doesn't it leaves people consciously, I think. It leaves people hung up. That is to say, they appreciate that everything's got an angle to it. Nothing is not surveillance. So where does that leave me? So
right.
People are left in a state of sort of fog at the moment.
And that's why, you have rampant fentanyl people, 300 people dying every day. People are committing suicide all over the place in different ways because it's too frightening, the void. They've been put into a world of a void too quickly, not used to it. Did I mention at the beginning that the missing word last time at the end was gyroscope?
Yeah, that's the word that you were looking for.
Yeah. Did I say that at the beginning of this session?
Mentioned the word. You mentioned the word, but you didn't go into anything.
Just putting on the record, just to get it on the tape, that the word I was looking for is gyroscope. So go back and listen to what I was saying in the previous show at the end and know the word I was looking for, because the gyroscope is an interesting phenomenon.
Yes, absolutely.
Way it moves.
In fact, when you brought it up last time, I mentioned that gyro means circle. And the implication is the maelstrom.
Right. Now, here's something. I asked Ion, do you agree that gyroscope means circle? And he said, no, it's orbital.
Orbital?
Yeah. So that
an orbit is a circle, right?
Right. But when I saw someone demonstrating, they sent me a YouTube, because I said this on the show, And so someone sent this YouTube, and the guy is showing how the gyroscope spins and slants and does this odd movements. It's not just a circular movement. There's angular momentum within it. I think that's what
Yeah, that's right. But it's always circling.
But there's several parts circling on different angles.
Yeah, that's right. It's like a top.
Yeah.
Right? So the way that the gyroscope or the top is able to maintain its balance at the different angles is because it's spinning. If it weren't spinning, it would just fall over.
So it's poly-spinning, poly-circles, the gyroscope.
Absolutely. It's like the world in that sense.
Yeah. That's a better image of the four worlds. They're spinning like a gyroscope, the four bodies. Yeah, my four bodies are spinning within a core spin.
I thought you were up to six or seven bodies now.
No, it's four, and then you add the mystery body. But since I couldn't get Clinton's friend to even talk about the five-body model, I'm on a program to simplify it, to say four, to get it out there. Yeah, but in actual fact, behind the scenes, we're operating on six bodies. We're in the hexadic situation. So what's interesting about this, I'm doing a supposedly a serious paper, but I have my random or sloppy conversational commentary going on with it. I have two styles here happening. I think that's kind of unique, isn't it? I don't think anybody's done that. I'm making a serious essay. There's the essay part, and then there's this me winging it, making up, trying to find patterns that the prose can't get to.
But it sort of goes back to ancient forms of composition, right? When people were copying texts, when the scribes were copying texts, they often made comments on the side,
right?
Or they often changed a word they didn't like.
The palimpsest.
They were copying, right?
Yeah.
This is going to the new by returning to the old.
Yeah. And so, but the actual thing itself, not many people.
Yeah, you're getting away from Gutenberg, right?
Yeah.
Gutenberg is all on one level, starting at a certain place and going to a certain end. And what you're doing is you're introducing gyroscopic movement on every page.
Yeah, while trying to be precise. That's one of the spins. Yeah, so that's pretty neat. So did you kind of pick up on that and like that? The parallel activities there. Did you appreciate?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's you're not only commenting on McLuhan, you're commenting on yourself.
Yeah.
So it's we've actually talked about this, I believe, in a previous show. The book is very complicated. In order to understand the book, you have to engage with it on many different levels.
Yeah.
And in fact, we're creating a new level in our conversation.
Yes. Yeah, that's what's so great to have someone talk about it and bounce back on me. So you go to page 116, and we have another quote from Take Today, another cover sleeve, you know, on the back of the book, on the cover sleeve, and it says, this is in more quotes within the sentence, the public becomes the participant consumer producer of hardware products and software information alike. So that's beginning to have multiple bodies, keeping the old environment going and yet engaging the new environment, and they are somehow, as categories, not factual. There is no hardware products. There is no software information in some way. Consumer producer of hardware products and software information. See, why would they be in quotes? There are hardware products. in understanding media, but now it's like 10 years later, and he's got to put that in quotes. He's got to put software in quotes. And he talks about, I think he talked about understanding media being both consumer and producer. Is that right? I think,
yes.
Yeah. The participant, consumer, producer, you can't tell who's making what. You know, who's the entrepreneur? Who's the passive victim? Everybody is playing all roles, both sides, in the tactility. So the participant, consumer, producer of hardware products and software information alike. So then I then try to talk about it. The mixture of them would be memes. Software information is a meme, obviously, but there are images of hardware, and people consume hardware imagery. Now that becomes an autonomic Android meme. The meme world is an Android, the information world that's not listening to you and not talking to you. It's not engaged in surveilling you. It's talking among its machinery parts. Okay, there I am saying what's being surveilling. It's surveilling itself, not you. As McLuhan used to say, quote, a bee goes from flower to flower and carries the pollen accidentally. It's pollinating the flowers, but it's irrelevant. It's not aware of what it's doing with the flowers. The flowers are taking advantage of the bee, and that's what kids are doing. They're typing memes to each other so that the Android meme seems to be doing something for humans among its machinic selves. I'm not sure what I mean by that, but that's what kids are doing. They're typing memes to each other so that the Android meme seems to be doing something for humans among its machinic selves. So, yeah, it's
true. Yeah. No, that makes good sense.
Okay, good. I'm glad someone gets it. Yeah, no, I think I know what you mean. It made sense there. But the idea is that the Android meme is not engaging humans. So the kids are pretending they're engaged. Now, that could be part of the reason they're so neurotically can't stop looking at their texting. Because it's so fascinating because they kind of feel it's a fake what they're talking about. There's no real purpose to it. And they want to see if anybody's cracking up while doing it. There's a real drama there watching your buddies keep up this ridiculous fatty communion. And everybody knowing it's a complete put-on and not leading to anything. But they can't let it go because it's the most nerve-wracking activity that's happening in your community, which is your peer group in school. That's your community. So I'm saying they're doing something for him, typing memes to each other so that the Android, they're helping, see, they're producing. They're helping the Android meme continuing its attempt to distract us from the fact it's not talking to us. They're typing to each other so the Android meme seems to be doing something for humans, but it's actually among its machinic selves.
Right. So I guess what I would ask about there is if the Android meme is not in dialogue except with itself, doesn't that locate the Android meme back in the back in the Gutenberg galaxy?
I'm trying not to say that. The Android meme is on a new front, and maybe the search for AI, humans are refusing to look at the post-Gutenbergian aspect of the Android meme. They're trying to put it back into the Gutenbergian characteristics. So the kids type to each other. They pretend to be communicating.
Yeah, yeah. So then what you're saying there is that the Android meme, like anything else, has a range of meanings.
Yeah,
it's not, and the Android meme is not something that can be avoided. You know, it would be like an octopus attacking the Great Pyramid, right? So the Android meme is a fact, if there were such a thing as a fact anymore, and it needs to be appreciated extra Gutenberg Galaxy. And so how to do that?
Yeah.
Right? Because it involves our identity. It involves everything.
Yeah. So somebody asked me, Bob, could you explain what the Android meme is? And I produced this 200-page book. They didn't know I'd have to go that far in answering them. Mm-hmm. It's a very hard question, what the Android meme is. But that's the tactility.
Right.
You can't have meaning alone. You have to have non-meaning going on.
Correct. That's we were talking about that a little while ago about how the undulation is not something abstract. It needs to be particular. And that's
you're
saying here. You could not have tactility by itself.
Yeah.
Tactility needs to be between things.
Yeah, what I call tactility, you call discontinuity.
Correct.
That's where we're saying what we're saying again.
And I think here I would say that the pollen is tactility and discontinuity, right? You say a bee goes from flower to flower and carries pollen accidentally.
Yeah. It's pollinating the flowers.
Right. But the flowers think that they're taking advantage of the bee. The bee thinks it's taking advantage of the flowers.
Right.
But what's really going on is that the pollen is being taken from here to there. So
yeah.
The pollen, you can say, is communication.
And that keeps life going. It's that we are actually keeping life going.
Correct. It's that's the undulation right there.
Yeah.
The undulation is the movement of the pollen between flowers, which pollinates the flowers, which is to say allows them to keep going.
Yeah, Zapp in an interview, right out of the blue, he said, radio is new life. That's an analog phase back in the 60s. Of I'm saying now you have the digital version of that. The people are making new life. So what, you know, we're the new fantasy is, okay, we will genetically engineer new lives. The womb can close. We don't need to have reproduction in the chemical body. We'll make the life. We're already doing that somehow. And that would be effects preceding the causes. We are, there was a bunch of rock critics at the Dia Center. We were talking about the carpenter's wife and the art world, the Demoniel people, and they had a big panel on rock culture. So all these rock critics were up on the panel. So when it was time for the audience to comment, I get up and I said, first of all, let's all recognize that you, every one of you guys up there on the panel, are genetic engineers. Croker's co-author, Michael Weinstein, in the great book Data Trash, his wife is a professor out there in Chicago or someplace.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's
they're all professors.
Yeah. And they're rock critics, you know what I mean? Writing, reviewing the Osmond sisters or whatever they are, or something stupid, right? It's something trivial. And so I noticed her, because she was on the panel, and she might have laughed a little bit because she would be around her wild husband, and that wouldn't be so far off in her world. And I later was talking to somebody, and I saw her walking by, skulking by me, looking at me, spying on me, so blatantly obvious, her face and her posture. And she was watching to see if I'd notice it, and I noticed it. And then years later, when her husband died, which was about 2 years ago or something, I called her up, introduced myself, and reminded her of that whole scene, but she didn't remember any of it. But we had a nice conversation, became friends conversationally. Discarnately for a minute, I always wanted to talk to her. I wish I would have liked to have responded to her at that point, because she was sort of intrigued. You know, hey buddy, you're using real accurate words. You reading Arthur Croker? You read my husband, don't you? Is what she was thinking, and but I couldn't leave who I was talking to. So, but I eventually got to talk to her. Now, that's how crazy I'm trying to say what the Android meme is. So we can't, if we're not stuck in the chemical body, we can't do normal analysis of bodies than to see how they're pregnant or not. We are producing other levels, and that creates other realities, other forms of life, and that's what makes the chemical body so futile and forlorn and abandoned and all the crazy stuff it's trying to do, as well as the TV body and the chip body. They're all on the, you know, on the dole now. They're all homeless. And so that's the new area we're in now, which I call the tech body.
That's okay, good. I like the I hadn't understood before the homeless aspect of
right.
the tech body. That's interesting.
Yeah,
that's the fate of the world is for humans are trying to find out who they are and what they should do, and the great question there is, well, where is your home?
Yeah.
What would it be to be at home? And that's what they don't know. That's what we don't know.
So we're global, and the ones, but it becomes a grievance. And so everybody thinks they're against being global, and they're saying some guys, the one percenters, are the globalists. So you're a globalist. You're a solar occupant, even. And so you're not recognizing how your terms don't express the problem, don't get to the issue. That's what makes Alex Jones and everybody that's known, anybody who's well known is a fool. You know, like
it's
Joe Rogan.
It's the qualification that's necessary.
Yeah. And so numbness, not intelligence, numbness makes wealth to the degree we need to hide in old costumes. Hardware products. So that's why hardware. So I gradually talk myself into understanding what the hell I just what my quote meant. That's why hardware products are in quotes. There's no such thing as hardware. You can't
Correct.
Determine where hardware and software begin and leave each other. So that's pretty neat. And again, it always no wonder McLuhan always said we go back and damn Finney's Wake got there first. I mean, the way he presented Finney's Wake is. It keeps up with what we're talking about. Its absurdity is no categories, no boundaries. That's what it had to do constantly, and that's what we're re-recognizing, recognizing what the Wake was pointing out, just like Marshall kept recognizing the Wake. So I have here, yes, McLuhan was intuiting. Now, this is the serious part. Yes, McLuhan was intuiting the environment of dismembered collective consciousness that was taking on a life of its own, what people first glimpsed in the film The Matrix 30 years later. Then I say, I quote myself, yes, McLuhan was intuiting the environment of dismembered collective consciousness. Bert, that's a guy in Switzerland, it's been fragmented. It's not collective anymore. It was taking on a life of its own, what people first glimpsed in the film The Matrix. He was intuiting it in the 60s, the living electronic environment, and it became a popular figure, in quotes, 30 years later in 99. The Wachowski brothers, they got McLuhan through Baudrillard. Remember that? They thought Baudrillard was their mentor. They wanted Baudrillard to help write the second and third movies in the Matrix series, and he responded, no, what you're making, your movie, The Matrix, is something The Matrix would have made. Baudrillard objected to that. So I say he dismissed them. They didn't know what they were talking about. Then I was told later Keanu Reeves was seen going into a Santa Monica bookstore asking for books by McLuhan. Then I make up this is his thought. This is the thought of Keanu Reeves. It's not Baudrillard. I've got to go back and read McLuhan. That's what Keanu realized. And I say, that's Keanu Reeves, the actor who played Neo in The Matrix, trying to figure out what The Matrix was all about. You know, that's... The actors, they make some movie, and they don't know what it's about, so they got to figure out. I mean, most movies were understandable until recently. If you were a star in the movie, you didn't have to figure out what it was about.
Wasn't he from Toronto?
Yes, yeah.
Keanu Reeves, yeah.
Yeah, I think his mother was a patient of Carolyn's.
Huh.
They lived in Yorkville. Yeah, no, that was discussed. So Then I say McLuhan anticipated the post-tactile. This is something that no one ever said. They don't even get to the tactile, right? They're back there with the eye, ear, oral, visual nonsense. But I'm saying, no, McLuhan even got post-tactile. He anticipated the post-tactile in his New York Times op-ed, September 21st, 1974. So now I'm going to read. This is an incredible quote.
This is all from McLuhan here coming up?
Yeah, this is his op-ed. It was called A Media Approach to Inflation.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome statement. September 21st, 1974. It's probably... That's the 70s McLuhan, what he was really working on that nobody had a clue. He wasn't depressed. You know, he wasn't upset. He was working on a new, more advanced version of Phineas Wake that was being made in front of us. And very different from the 60s McLuhan or the 50s McLuhan or the 40s McLuhan. So this is a good one. We're going to read it. It is the peculiar character of the gambler that he seeks to exploit this very nothing or interval as a situation with its own laws. So it's nothing, but it's got its own laws. See? Wow. Anybody who was honest would read this. Well, what the hell is McLuhan saying here? What the heck is this? The gambler seeks to exploit the very nothing or interval as a situation with its own laws. Now, I guess I was trying to say that when I talked about my friend gambling and feeling in the zone, and then, hey, I'm in the zone, I'm doing great. Oh, fuck, I shouldn't have noticed it. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's what this is about. The gambler, he's in the nothing. On this situation, or reified interval, he's prepared to make his bet. And it is the intervals in the processes of the commodity market, which at electric speed are projected as figure or thing. The interval is the thing, the nothing. The Russian roulette player stakes his life on the intervals in the chamber. The enthralling and all-involving fascination of Russian roulette is the obsession with the gap or interval. So McLuhan is saying the interval is what's marketed in the 70s on Wall Street. The nothing.
Isn't this, can't we say that this goes back to what you were just saying about the kids?
Making nothing to imitate the best back of the Android meme. That's why the market is not making products or software. It's engaging in this very intimate tactility with the Android meme and pretending they're not being fooled by it or pretending they get it or something, you know?
Yeah.
It's your what were the two things? You submit to it or you try to steer it. So when you become aware of what's happening, you get frustrated because the steering thing surfaces. Yeah, I don't even know if you can have those different functions. You wouldn't be able to tell which is which when you're doing it.
Oh, absolutely. They flip. No question about it.
Okay. So this is what McLuhan's trying to say here about the market. Like the current dealing in futures at electric speeds, Russian roulette accelerates the older forms of gambling. Now, we might be able to project on it. Putin accelerates the older forms of gambling. The answer comes quickly, the whole Ukraine thing. The answer comes quickly, and the fascination is in the ratio to the speed of the answer. The fascination of the one-armed bandit or slot machine. One-armed bandit. At this point, Maslow's rule comes into play. Quote, the closer a need comes to being satisfied, the larger an increment of additional gratification will be required to produce the same satisfaction. You said that an hour ago. You said something, we were making more to make more of the opposite. Remember that statement you made?
Yeah.
So, the new inflation goes beyond all markets. So, it's not even involved in business. The new inflation goes beyond all markets, turning them into art form or playgrounds for economic playboys. The breakdown of markets into playgrounds may also point to a cure for inflation, a cure beyond economics and politics. When the planet becomes a theater for the new role players like Henry A. Kissinger. He is neither a bureaucrat nor a professor nor a politician, but all of these things at once. That's where I get into quadrophenia, right? We're all playing these multiple roles. The fact that our economy is now constituted in large degree by information structures of pulsating data, like that of the TV image, means that there. So the TV image was ground, it became figure, and became business. what they call economics, the pulsating data, the undulating sirens.
Yeah, so everything that he's talking about in these paragraphs is an attempt to reify something that can't be reified.
Right. And therefore, you can't have wealth, you can't have identity, you can't have any of the Gutenberg distinctions.
Yep.
And, you know, that's maybe the way Aboriginal people lived. They all hunted and survived and found things and shared because there was no distinctions between things.
Yeah, that's the direction McLuhan is going in, no question about it.
Yeah.
And I believe that's what he meant by orientalizing.
Yeah, yeah. The fact that our economy is now constituted in large degree by information structures of pulsating data, like that of the TV image, means that there are innumerable new intervals in every social situation which provide opportunities for new involvements and obsessions, endless games with futures in antiques, in horoscopes, fashions, and commodities. Everything becomes make wagers on. That would be making wagers on the undulations, what's going to go up and what's going to go down.
Right.
Such opportunity. Now, this is look how amazing this article is. You know, nobody deals with this, but he said here. It's like his last great swan song, right?
Yeah, he's attempting to say how to read the world.
Yeah, a more complex world than the 60s. Such opportunities are nowhere thicker than in the old commodity markets of supply and demand, especially when they move at the speed of light. It is here that it's possible to buy up futures in oil or meat or grain or real estate or antiques using the time intervals between supply and demand as the point of intervention and gambling. At electric speed, it is possible to play Russian roulette with whole economies. That's George Soros with London in 1992. Remember? He crashed the pound. At electric speed, it is possible to play Russian roulette with whole economies, with entire educational systems, and with political regimes. So maybe Trump scares people because he was kind of a Russian roulette with the sacred White House, or even the way he campaigned. You know, he was a George Soros of political campaigning. He hijacked the whole process.
I was just going to say this is the hijacking theme.
Yeah. Which is earlier, we did that. That's a few pages back. Henry Kissinger seems to be the current triggerman. Now, that's for McLuhan. That's the Big Brothers, the deep state guys, the one who looks like he's in charge, the closest to looking, because he's so inside with the. With the Gutenberg categories of the Rockefellers and the wealthy and the powerful and the this and the that, you know. And he's hanging around with all of them, so he looks like to be their representative. Henry Kissinger sees, remember, he says way back in 1951 in the letter to Pound, June 22nd, I'm going to create a distraction on the sidelines for the triggerman and needle the somnambulist citizen. He doesn't say citizens, that's what he means. So he's going to needle the Big Brother guys. And they distract, you know, upset their language that they're trying to impose on people. At the same time, wake up the average numbskull to where they are, how homeless they are. So I think he says the word triggerman way back there.
Yeah, around 1951, I think that was.
Yep, June 22nd. And it's, you never see it again in any published stuff until this, until 74. There's an interview, maybe his last interview, somebody did out in California in 79 that Nelson and I came across. He says, Kissinger comes up and he says, well, that's the kiss of death. He said the nickname for Kissinger is the kiss of death. Henry Kissinger seems to be the current triggerman in this planetary game among the intervals, the first, second, third, and fourth worlds. The first world being the industrialized West, the second being Russian socialism, the third, the non-industrialized lands, and the fourth, the electric world that has gone around the rest, becoming the primum mobile of inflation in all the rest. Wow. What? What a mouthful. It was a lot of fun reading this for the first time. When you read, if you half understood McLuhan and you read something great that was new, it would be so mind-expanding or something. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It would be very exciting. It would be like a great music performance or a great opera or a great classical or a great rock song or something. It had these aesthetic triggers, aesthetic massages going on. I mean, there's a lot of fun to read that over and over and try to figure out what it is. And then
to me, all of this stuff says that everything that you think is going on is palimpsest.
Yes.
And you need to read the text that's on the other side of what you're looking at.
Yeah, you have to look at what's beneath the palimpsest, the markings and scribblings that erase the original text. So I then say in the series part, I named this radical non-extension. Yeah, it's not an extension of us. It's an extension of its parts, of the machining parts. I named this radical non-extension the Android meme in a column I wrote for Flipside magazine in the 96-2002 era. The uniqueness of this new situation was perceived by McLuhan as beginning with the technology known as the instant replay. And then we go into the instant replay. Now, how are we doing for time?
Well, we're coming up to 6 o'clock our time. As far as I'm concerned, we can go on a while, but we need to be aware that we're coming up to the end.
Yeah, and you don't have to do something around this time?
Oh, I don't know when this happened, but our poor dog died.
What?
I can't remember if this happened in the intervening period. So I used to need to feed our dog around now, but the poor guy died.
Just a week or so ago.
Yeah, yeah.
He just dropped it?
He went to sleep and never woke up. He didn't have a prolonged period of being sick, which was good.
Yeah. But it was just it was a big surprise. Didn't expect it.
Oh, terrible. Terrible. Well, we knew that he wasn't feeling well.
Yeah.
And we had been taking him to the vet to try to figure out what was going on. But we never did figure it out. And this night he went to sleep. And in the morning when I went to see how he was dead.
So what do you do with a dead dog? Where do you take it?
Well, there's different possibilities, but we took them to a place to be cremated.
Mm. And you get it done the same day?
Yes.
Right. So you just go in there. You don't do a ceremony, or you could do a ceremony if you want to, but we just get rid of it. So what was the dog's name?
Pogo.
Pogo. P-O-G-O?
Yes, sir.
Mm. So... Yeah, so you're free.
Not in a good way. I miss that dog a lot.
Right. How long did you have him?
He died young. He was only 10, but we had him since he was a puppy, so we had him 10 years.
10 years. Yeah. Okay, but that was part of your life. That you anchored
very
with
much.
The ritual.
Very much.
5:30 in the morning, feeding the dog.
That's correct.
Your identity was shattered.
Correct.
All right. So the uniqueness of this new situation was perceived by McLuhan as beginning with the technology known as the instant replay. So then I have the tetrad, instant replay. So enhances, or it says, instant replay of experience equals the cliche, amplifies cognitive awareness, wipes out the merely representational and chronological. You got to scan past the blue part. Retrieves meaning. I.A. Richards did the book, The Meaning of Meaning. So retrieves meaning in quotes. Flips from individual experience to pattern recognition, the nature of the archetype. So that's in Marshall McLuhan and Bruce Powers. book, The Global Village, 1989, page 176. So then you have I have a quote from McLuhan addressing students in his brother's class at Sheridan School of Art and Design, Mississauga, Ontario, in January 75. This was caught in video by Richard Kerr. He says, "I think the instant replay is probably the most powerful experience that you will ever have in your lifetime." He's saying that to the university students. So what do I say? Do you have anything to say about this at this point, or do I keep talking?
Well, I mean, the instant replay is obviously a big theme in McLuhan and is very important to consider. But I'm interested in the word that you use, non-extension.
Right.
And you quickly sort of glossed it by saying it's the non-extension of the human.
Yeah.
But isn't there an aspect of the Android meme itself that is a non-extension? Isn't the, for example, you talk about the Android meme just talking to its parts. And so it's a non-extension in itself, you could say, or at least one aspect of the Android meme.
Yeah, it is doing a lot of extending within its world. So it's a non-extension. I'm throwing that in, even though it's not correct, if you analyze it the way you just did. But I'm reinforcing the point that you were supposed to get earlier, that we have stopped extending ourselves, and we are extending it, the machine is extending itself. So that's the only time I've ever said that. I just say non-extension, you're supposed to understand what that means. If you don't get it, you didn't get what I'm saying, that the Android meme is beyond the extensions that McLuhan outlines in Understanding Media.
Mm-hmm. But isn't a surprising word like that an attempt to get people to think? Isn't it saying, here's where you should do some thinking?
Yeah.
And there's no stability here. There's no handle here. It's a kind of confusion that you need to go into in order even to begin thinking.
Yeah. So it's like I'm teaching a bunch of kids, and then I pull out a gun and I tell the student to shoot another student. A totally, bizarre, unpredicted, absurd action. That's why I put in this word that had never been said before in that sentence. To wake people up to a new level that they were sort of maybe half getting when they were enjoying the literate prose of my explanation. But suddenly I stuck it, put them inside the Android meme, saying non-extension, because I don't even remember doing this, but I did it. I named this radical non-extension. Like, geez, when you're doing McLuhan, everybody uses the word extension. So it's a good disruptor to make people think or to notice what's being thought about in front of you.
And you use the word radical in front of it. Which means that the various extensions that McLuhan is always talking about do not exclude at the most fundamental level non-extension.
Yeah. I was trying to communicate the new. This is the way you got to do it. The whole thing, the 50, the 100 pages was to lead to this sentence. Radical non-extension? What's that? Has Bob left the reservoir? Left the plantation? Now over in the anomalous school? Suddenly he's Andy McLuhan.
So when you write this stuff, Bob, are you
very conscious?
That's
it's no dreamy writing, dreamily, and that's why I think McLuhan is conscious, because I do it, so I'm projecting that into him.
So when you're writing stuff like this, and you come up with something that is unusual and surprising, does it make you laugh?
Yes. You know the story? The McClune family says every now and then Marshall come bursting out of his bedroom or wherever he was writing in his home and say, "This is going to mess them up." Something like that. "This will get them." As if everybody was in. Oh, yeah, Marshall's in there. He's going to get those guys down at the university campus. You know what I mean? He's going to do some sniping. But he goes running out saying, "This will get them." Something like that. You know, this is going to really upset them. I do that all the time. I could, even when I'm on the radio show, even when I'm talking to you, I'm talking along and I see I'm going to say, I said, "Oh, this will get Cameron." You know, looking at the effects before they happen. Is that, do you do that when you write your probe, your blog?
Yes, I often have the experience of understanding a connection or understanding a disconnection or something like that that I hadn't seen before, that it's only become available to me by writing.
Yeah, and so you're laughing. I don't laugh out loud. I'm laughing inside myself. Is that what you're doing?
Yes, although, yeah. I mean, if something is really new, if some like every 5 years or something, I'll have a thought that makes me laugh out loud.
Yeah, maybe I laugh, but I do a lot of laughing inside.
You do a lot of laughing when you're on the radio or when you're
somebody,
talking. You're enjoying the,
that's right.
The dialogue, which is mostly dialogue with yourself.
Yeah, and Michael of South Africa says, Bob, interacting with Ion, you know, all these years on the radio, no one has laughed as much as Bob has on this radio show because Ion is funny. Now, when I am presented self as a hologram of JW, I don't know if I ever told you about this, but this happened in November 2014. What I noticed, the hologram, so here was Ion manifesting as a form, not human, but looking exactly like JW and floating around the room. We're watching it on Skype. It, as I was talking to it, I would be finishing up my statement, and then they were going to say something. I could see a slight grin being on its face because it knew it was going to be funny in its response or be something I didn't see. I could see that on its face. You know what I mean? On the hologram's face. I could see them smiling at what they were going to do, what they were going to say. So even the hologram is enjoying itself. You get that?
Are you?
Now, when I'm doing the show with Ion, Ion has a great sense of humor, and I can hear something coming, a joke, funny, and that, so I can hear it as well as seeing it in the hologram. Really, I have a great time interacting with Ion. And people, but it's always in, Ion's there for 12 hours, constantly, ready to laugh or to notice, to make new perceptions. So, yeah, it is very enjoyable. You've noticed that in what you've heard of the show? Is that what you
were saying? Yeah, well, you know, I don't listen to your show very much. What I do is occasionally you'll send me a link and say, you should listen to this or something. And so I do. And so I've heard how you interact.
A lot of laughter, yeah.
That's right.
Okay, so the instant replay of experience equals the cliche, amplifies cognitive awareness, wipes out the merely representational and chronological, retrieves meaning, and then flips from individual experience to pattern recognition, the nature of the archetype. Now, that's very packed. So I go back up. We were going to do this, and then we got distracted. So my first blue commentary back before the media approach inflation. No, I did that. Good. Okay, so we move forward to just talk of the instant replay.
Yeah, you're in the middle. What you do is instead of going with the four, you break it after the two.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're going to just clarify where the instant replay consideration is going.
Right. So I say Gutenberg painting back in the day in the Gutenberg matching era, you tried to make your painting look just like the object you were painting. You'd match the two. That's representing the object. A painting is a representation, and that's spatial. Then there's time. That's chronological. Chronological is the 1 to 10 order. So the whole literate structure is representational and chronological. That gets wiped out. That's obsolesced by the instant replay. In a way, the archetype is wiped out because the instant replay expands the cliche probe. Reading that again. In a way, the archetype is wiped out because the instant replay expands the cliche probe. It equals the cliche.
Right. So there's no time element whereby the archetype becomes cliche. The archetype is already cliche.
Yeah. Yeah, no time and no space. So I then say you've got both the cliche and the archetype in here. It bypasses obsolescence and extension in a way. Well, look at that. We're archetypalizing and clicheing. And the merely representational and chronological is like normal prose, scientific prose, explaining something which retrieves meaning. I.A. Richards was one of McLuhan's professors at Cambridge. He wrote a book, The Meaning of Meaning, which was an important influence on James Joyce and Marcel Duchamp. The flipping goes from individual to collective, but the collective is pattern recognition. The observation of individual experience and then projecting sociological patterns, so to speak, that's what we do. And that's what the instant replay does on its own, regardless of what humans think. So, you know, a big part of the Android meme is endless pattern recognition that's offered to people.
Yeah, but you just finished saying that it's really not offered to people. It's only offered to itself.
That's right. Yes.
So humans, I guess.
It's not individual experience.
Right. It's like what we were saying about when somebody is on a roll, let's say gambling or playing. In the zone. When somebody's in a zone, you can't wake up without destroying the bubble, if you will.
Yeah.
So the problem for humans is to try to understand how they are going to accord with the new reality without according. That's just, right? I mean,
yeah.
You need to be in the zone without going into the zone.
Yeah, you wake up, you get out of the bubble without waking up.
It's a very, very difficult problem.
Well, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous to do this, but we're going to have to do it, apparently. Remember McLuhan? He said you can't live. You can't live with this technology. You know, what you have to be able to do is pretty hard to do.
Right. But if you say it's this ridiculously hard problem, that has made it into what it's not.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So
it's easy.
That would be a mode of steering. If you thought you could solve the problem, if you thought you could take your identity from here to there or something, then you've made it impossible.
That's right. That's the steering that doesn't work.
One thing, just as a footnote here, that we, I.A. Richards, who wrote The Meaning of Meaning in 22 and was giving a course on rhetoric in 1935, which McLuhan took.
Yeah.
So McLuhan knew I.A. Richards personally, but only as a student to the professor.
Yeah.
I.A. Richards in 1939 went to Harvard and stayed at Harvard for the rest of his life.
Mm.
So another student of I.A. Richards Cambridge, this was in the 1920s, was Eric Havelock.
Wow.
And in 1946, when I.A. Richards was a university professor at Harvard, Harvard recruited Havelock. And I'm not sure if Richards played a role
right.
in that. I'm not sure if Richards knew Havelock from the 1920s at Cambridge.
Yeah.
At any rate, at Harvard, I.A. Richards and Havelock became friends. And Havelock's theories about oral education and the switch from morality to literacy in Greece became very influential with Richards. And Richards kind of built that into his basic English emphasis. And Richards at Harvard started translating Plato and Homer.
Wow.
So
how long did he live?
Richards up until the 1970s. I believe he died around 75 or so. I'm not exactly sure. But his Festschrift was given to him in 1973.
What's that? A Festschrift? I know the word, but I don't know what it means.
A celebration. Celebration of his life.
Oh, okay. At Harvard.
Festschrift. Well, as a professor who had great influence on the contributors to the volume, one of which was Havelock.
Right. Is it a roast? A Festschrift?
No. Fest is the same word as English feast.
Yeah.
And shrift is the same word as the script. The Festschrift is a celebratory writing.
Oh, it's a book of essays on him.
Yeah, dedicated to him, yes.
Right.
In fact, the book is titled In His Honor. So
right.
E.A. Richards, or I.A. Richards, In His Honor. And so it was it's a celebration and a thanking.
Yeah, so that... Do they write about his work, or do they write about anything?
They can write about anything, but
yeah.
usually people write about his work or write about something else, which they then correlate with his work.
Okay, so that's very interesting that two people, very influential on McLuhan in the early years, team up on their own, away from McLuhan.
That's right. And but one thing to notice in this complex is that in McLuhan's thesis from 1943, he begins with classical Greece. And then comes forward to the Elizabethan era. Then he does something of the same sort in the Gutenberg Galaxy, but he starts before the classical era.
Mm.
And what he says at the start of that book is that he is going to consider the Perry Lord thesis of orality. Well, the Perry Lord thesis on orality was started at Harvard. And was going on with I.A. Richards and Havelock. So
after Perry?
Yeah, well, Perry died in an accident in 34 or 35. So Albert Lord then carried on his work
right.
at
and,
Harvard.
And so did Havelock and...
Richards. So yeah, so the start of the Gutenberg Galaxy is a kind of a nod to this history that we're talking about.
Right. So McLuhan is thinking through Richards and Havelock.
Havelock. Yeah.
Wow, and he thinks he's moving along farther than them. You know, that they may not even understand how he jumped off from their work.
Yeah, but that's a chronological understanding, and what McLuhan is tending towards, as you know, is a sort of an interplay of the media themselves that is timeless.
Yeah. So, this point, the observation of individual experience and then projecting sociological patterns, that's what we do.
Yeah, that's what we're just talking about right now.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, like there's a constant demand on people to state an opinion about what's going on. You know, the old literate projecting yourself over the civilization. McLuhan said sociology was the last gasp of Gutenberg writing. And so we are projecting over the population and supposed to know what's going on in the collective ESP, or as if we had ESP. You know what I mean? That's what a lot of news, Fox and CNN, are people commenting on what's going on in general, projecting sociologically. And so that would be the human being trying to, like kids, imitate the collectivity that the Android meme is making. And so this is why the news changed to people just giving opinions about what's going on, right? And how far is the temperature of the body politic gone too far or not? That's what I guess I'm getting at there when I talk about it's a world of collective experience, no more individual experience, collective pattern recognition.
Sure. Well, isn't that what we've been talking about the whole time?
Yep.
That there's this undulation, and human beings as a species need to figure out their relation to it.
They seem to be aware
like
of that.
Identity.
They're always talking about it, but that's the problem. They're talking the elephant in the room, but not having a vocabulary to gather around.
Correct.
And I claim I have the vocabulary they can say, they can use. Just like McLuhan, he thought he had the vocabulary for everybody. Remember Rabelais? He quotes somebody saying Rabelais told everybody to put down their plow and read his books. So McLuhan then did it orally by going out in the public sphere of television and asking people to think with his terms, with his categories.
And yeah, but I would say that the emphasis there is think. The categories themselves are irrelevant. Right, it's the categories you need to think through, in the sense of in two different senses. First, to allow the light of those categories to come towards you. That's what McLuhan called light through.
Yeah.
And then the other sense of thinking through the categories is see the categories as the foreground text under which there's another text. So the palimpsestic theme that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah. So the language that he insisted on people use was to get them out of the content and into the form, and then he doesn't dictate. You won't come back and have his maybe solution or pattern. They might come back, and then that's interesting if people keep coming back to the same pattern, but he lets you go forward with the formula. You have the right tools. His words are the closest to starting off properly and not getting distracted mm-hmm. by the content.
Well, what you say in your next commentary in the blue goes to this. So maybe we should end up with what you say there about cliché and archetype.
Okay, so that's not the sign in the junkyard.
This is at the bottom of 119, just after
Yeah, I read that. I read that. I go, you've got both the cliche and the archetype in here. It bypasses obsolescence and extension in a way. Remember? I read that. Are you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm here. I'm just rereading it. Yeah.
Okay,
good. I wasn't, I guess I wasn't in the moment there because now when I'm rereading this, I'm seeing that there's a lot in it that I wasn't following before.
Yeah.
So this flipping goes from individual to collective, but the collective is pattern recognition. And what he means there is that the once you recognize pattern recognition, you recognize that the individual identity comes from the pattern recognition, not that the individual identity can read the pattern recognition.
That's right.
There's a flip in direction there.
And so if the kids are having a hard time getting body percept, what you just said is why the kids, you know, 1 week they want to be a girl and then 2 weeks later they want to be a guy. That's shifting. It's what you just indicated, the way you said that. The individual merging with the pattern recognition. That's where their identity comes from, the pattern recognition. And the problem is, as Trump symbolized, there's too many patterns being made in 10 hours for people. So much rapid turnover, which is apparently why the global economies collapsed, because they were printing trillions of dollars, and then there was a point that they forgot to notice that they could never pay it back. It was just too much. So they went into the void. That's where we're at today, according to Ion.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the Bank of England will not be able to recover. They made everybody bankrupt.
Yeah, but I personally, I don't think that they were printing all this money and not noticing that it couldn't be paid back. I think they were printing the money knowing that it couldn't be paid back.
Yes, and then what's the reaction to that?
Well, the collapse of everything.
And move it into digital. Move into the...
We'll see about that. We'll see about that. That's easy to say, but hard to do.
Yeah, that's why they brought in the troops in London to monitor the reaction of the media colleges in the population.
Sure. Well, so, I mean, if people can't feed themselves and can't heat themselves, then of course you're going to have enormous problems.
And look at China. They got people locked in their buildings, in their high rises.
Because of COVID, you mean?
Yeah, well, right now, for different reasons, whatever they're going through, it's too many things going on there, floods and stuff. But, yeah, they won't let them out of their buildings. Yeah, the bank, they're not allowed to get out of their buildings to go to the bank and get some money, and their tanks are surrounded the banks.
Yeah, the world, I mean, imagine the world coming to this.
Imagine the world what?
Coming to this.
Yeah, but it does make sense if you understand McLuhan.
Well, you can see through it. I wouldn't call it making sense. I would say it's senseless. But coming to terms with senselessness is what McLuhan's all about.
Yeah, and we are explaining what people are seeing today and what they're finding meaningless or crazy.
We're trying to, yeah. We're trying to.
And maybe what we say can't even be understood. You have to know the jargon, know the formula, and then know how to talk within it, which is what we do every episode. So I think I was going to say, what is this? So there's a long quote there. Basically I was describing how we became sociological patterns or collective experience, and you were thinking about something else. But I was busy explaining this quote. Then he said, well, let's read this quote. But I had been explaining it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Because I was hung up on the idea of introducing a footnote about Richards and Havelock.
Right. which was interesting. Oh, so end with this. Did you on office hours on our show today, Clinton? We were going through a couple of tetrads. So we, the one for media ecology, it enhances pattern recognition, obsolescence to retrieve something, but it flips into programming the environment. So media ecology doesn't mean making sure Venezuela gets radio when they need it. That's not media ecology. That flips into something else, which is he called programming the world, programming something. This is in the Lost Tetrads, if you want to look it up. Do you have that book?
Somebody gave me that book electronically. Maybe it was Clinton. But I haven't. But I haven't read it.
Okay, so look up that one, the media ecology, because I realized that I went on the radio in the mid '80s, doing the flip of media ecology by doing a programmed environment and saying, "Look, we're going to have to turn off this thing or that for a few weeks." You know, I was doing the Playboy interview. Nobody was doing that. No one even knew about it to do it. But in the McLuhan field, de Kerckhoff wasn't doing that. He was doing pattern recognition or media ecology, the first part. But I was doing this weird, maybe go back to the beginning. I was trying to steer the world.
Right. So, we disagree on the application of pattern recognition. But we agree that pattern recognition does have an application.
Yeah, that's right. So I just wanted to point out that in that tetrad that McLuhan was not doing media ecology. If you understand that tetrad, he was in the fourth level. He flipped out of it into trying to program the world. He'd become uptight.
You think trying to program the world is right? Or recognizing that the world is programmed is different from trying to program the world?
No, he on the surface, he was saying we need to program it. Whether he meant it, or whether it was satire, who knows? But he tried to build the big institute to do that, but they didn't know how to analyze sensory thresholds, which is what they said they had to measure. You know, Daniel Capon blew it, that computer guy.
Well, but he took McLuhan with him for a while.
Yeah. So it's all the fourth level exegesis. It's anagogical, ultimate mysteries, eschatological is what a lot of McLuhan in the 60s was, eschatological, grasping for straws, you know?
Sure. Because of the closeness to death that he was leading.
Say it again, the closeness to what?
Death.
Yeah, death, that he was leading.
He was having blackouts.
Yeah.
His brain was in danger of being ruptured. He was...
That's called being honest.
Yeah.
He was the only public intellectual who would dare demonstrate it.
Yeah. Well, it raises all sorts of questions about what should you do? What should you leave? What has been your life?
Your light or life?
Life.
L-I-F-E.
Yeah.
Well, those are very... Hello.